Hello and welcome to the Radio Thrift Shop with DJ Frederick here on WSCS 90.9 FM in New London and online at classicalwscs.org. Thrift Shop is your weekly show of musical and media exploration from the past century of recorded sound. Celebrating 78s, 33s, 45s, tapes, and homemade CDs and other musical releases, Radio Thrift Shop, it's analog culture for a digital world. We're going to start today's thrift shop off with the Beatles, harkening back to 1963.
Oh, come on, come to me. Do this for the first time. Oh, come on, come to me. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein.
Ja, das wird sie verstehen. Und dann verzeiht sie dir. Oh ja, sie liebt dich. Schöner kann es gar nicht sein. Ja, sie liebt dich. Und da solltest du dich freuen. Sie liebt dich, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sie liebt dich, yeah, yeah, yeah. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein.
seeking shelter from the weather. It was on a rainy April day. You remember how we got together in a shop across the way. After being caught with no umbrella, I stopped in to have a cup of tea. Just for fun I called the fortune teller. A lucky day for me. It was in a little gypsy tea room. I was feeling blue. It was in a little gypsy tea room I first laid eyes on you. When a gypsy came to read the tea leaves, it made me feel quite gay. When she said that someone in the tea room would steal my heart away, I really thought it inconceivable. Just imagine my surprise. You made the story quite believable, right there in front of my eyes. With a smile that's sweeter than the roses, you made a dream come true. It was in a little gypsy tea room I gave my heart to you.
Kind of a fun set here on the Thrift Shop. That was R. Crumb in his cheap suit serenaders with Singing in the Bathtub. Before that, from 1935 in a great 78, Jan Garber in a little gypsy tea room. Before that, Fred Lowery, the great whistler, with Dorothy Ray and Song of the Island. We started off with the Beatles singing in German two of their early releases, She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand. I'll be back with more music right after this.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. It takes an unusual film to have us laughing out loud and horrified at the same time. This is the case with the 2009 documentary, The Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia. The Whites are a contemporary lawless clan that knows how to party no matter what the consequence. Don't get in their way. Crossing them could lead to a bad end. They speak of stabbing errant husbands and shooting no good uncles with particular delight. One can only guess what might happen to an outsider who displeases them. This is a thoroughly balanced look at a tough family to watch. The music and dancing are wonderful, the history of the clan as it evolves from the corrupt practices of corporate coal cartels is riveting, and the terrifying lawlessness is a legacy which will clearly continue. The younger offspring delight in demonic behavior as their parents drink, drug, and party their lives away. A lot of credit goes to director Julia Nitzberg, who spent a full dangerous year filming the colorful outlaw clan in their mountain home. Through his film, we get the opportunity to observe a fascinating piece of Americana, the wild and wonderful whites of West Virginia. Real? Oh my. Horrific? Yes. Entertaining? Absolutely. Indie Film Minute. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Thank you. is how it stands today. You decide he was wise. Storyteller makes no choice. Soon you will not hear his voice. His job is to shed light and not to master.
Thank you.
while you were gone. These spaces filled with darkness, the obvious was here, with nothing to believe in. The compass always points to Jeremiah. Sudden wings of fortune beat like rain.
The Grateful Dead with Terrapin Station Part 1 from their 1977 LP, Terrapin Station. And that incarnation of the Dead was Jerry Garcia on guitar, Donna Jean Gacho on vocals. I'm probably massacring that name yet again. Keith Gacho on keyboards, Mickey Hart and Bill Kreutzmann on drums, Phil Lesh on bass, and Bob Weir on guitar. Well, this is DJ Frederick. You're listening to the Radio Thrift Shop on WSCS 90.9 FM in New London. Also at the Global Voice at theglobalvoice.info. If you've been listening to the Radio Thrift Shop for long, you'll know that from time to time I like to include audio documentaries of various sorts and sundry on various topics. Last month, we heard part one of a documentary on the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting. And today, we're going to hear part two, Mark Durenberger interviewing Steve Raymer from the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting. And this is from the National Radio Club's DX audio service.
Thanks, Dave, and Happy New Year, everyone. Hope you had a nice holiday season and are gearing up for 2015. Last month, we began a bit of time travel at the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting, walking through some of the hundreds of exhibits with curator Steve Raymer. We ran out of time just as we were entering the radio receiver side of the museum. So let's go back. Steve's waiting in the hallway.
We went from the spark gap era of no voices and no music to the beginning of the broadcast era.
You did that yourself with a mallet.
That's right. We don't have a set of the electronic Ranger chimes. And you recognize those notes.
Done so well.
GEC.
GEC. There was a lot of discussion about the fact that there was a fourth note, which was used during the war particularly, to alert stations that a news flash might be coming.
We have one of those.
Do you?
Yeah.
A news flash or a fourth?
We have a set of chimes with four bars on it.
Now, we can't cover everything, but
no,
that's such a good start.
So the Pavic collection is chronologically ordered along the wall here. And this first case is the early spark gap pre-voice era equipment. And once again, some of it is out where everybody can touch it and feel it. Then we get into the first voices with an Alexanderson alternator that's sitting here. Some crystal detectors, the first vacuum tubes. And then World War I. World War I played a significant role in the development of radio. Because up until that time, until the U.S. got involved in the war, all those inventors were stealing from each other and suing each other. But when the war broke out, they were forced to work together for a couple years. And when the war ended, they were all on the same page. They had the product. They had the parts. The first radio stations came on the air. And we now walk into the big room full of equipment, full of advertising, full of broadcast radios. And this is what happened. It was a big explosion of technology and culture starting in 1920. Now, much of the Pavic collection is battery sets from the 1920s. Up until 1927, everything ran on batteries. They really didn't know how to make a radio run on house current. Back over here, we have a 1924 Atwater Kent.
Have you noticed how much more respectful Steve's voice has gotten since we came into this room?
So here's one of the, here's a typical radio from 1924. It's got three big tuning dials and two volume controls, and it's connected to one, two, three, four great big batteries. It's got an external horn speaker, and it has 60 feet of wire going up in the air for an antenna. And by the time you paid for this thing in 1924, you had almost $200 tied up in it.
That was a lot of money.
Oh, it was a month's wages for many people. But imagine a world when there was no radio, and then all of a sudden you could tune in to music and weather reports and news and sports. People did without everything just to have a radio. And this is the Atwater Kent. You're welcome to come in and try it out. Turn it on.
That's coming out of a horn speaker up on the ceiling here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the horn was the first kind of loudspeaker, and that was followed by a paper cone. Which is a little bit
getting
better.
Getting a little better, yeah.
Yeah. But if you really wanted to hear good sound in the late 20s and early 30s, you went to the movie theater, where you could hear speakers like these great big Western Electric theater horns that we've got here.
My word, those things must be...
I think they're 5 feet tall.
5 feet tall and about 8 feet wide, mm-hmm. looks like.
And one of these was enough to fill an entire theater with sound. We're standing about, 10 feet away from one of these big loudspeakers, Western Electric 16A, and we're going to use as a source the rarest thing in the museum, the Jack Mullen magnetophone.
What is that?
Well, Jack Mullen, you remember, was Bing Crosby's audio engineer. He was over in Germany while he was still in the service before he ever met Bing Crosby, and he was up late at night and he heard an orchestra playing. They sounded live. And no one could figure out how the Germans were getting an orchestra up at 2 in the morning. So when his tour of duty ended and the rest of his buddies went down to Paris to drink and party, Mullen went to the radio station to find out how they were doing it. He found these machines, which he claims, I don't know if this is true or not, that since the Germans never bothered to classify these as top secret, we knew nothing about them. And had they been top secret, we'd have known everything about
them.
Sure,
sure.
So he sent a couple home, and he was showing them to his friends. And one of his friends said, I know a guy who works for Bing Crosby. And Crosby's trying to pre-record his show, and it's not working.
He was using disc.
He was recording to disc and then editing from disc to disc, and it was terrible. Enter Mullen. And this is the very machine that recorded the 1947-48 Bing Crosby season.
This is a tape recorder, which has a German stamp on it. So this is actually one of the machines that Hitler built for use in Germany during the war. Why? What were they using them for? Wiretapping or for recording music programs?
They were doing a lot of things. Entertainment. They were also recording speeches. You know, the old story about the Allies never knew where Hitler was because you could hear his voice out of Munich, or you could hear him coming out of Berlin. Well, it was many times it was a tape recording of it.
We also hear that they used the tape recorder to edit FDR's speeches to make him say things that he didn't say and play those to the German people. All right, now Steve is warming up this well-built machine. It's obviously got some miles on it.
Yeah, this is made in 1940.
It's a standard reel-to-reel tape recorder. How fast does it run?
It runs at 30 IPS.
30 IPS, that's 4 times the normal consumer speed. And what are we going to hear? We're going to hear something from the Crosby show, but it's going to be played through those big speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll stand back and put the...
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about this machine. This machine was manufactured in 1940, as was this tape. This is original German tape from 1940.
Mercy. All right, I'm going to put the... Let me get somewhere in the middle here. We're standing back away from the big speakers.
From the world's largest radio manufacturer, Philco, famous for quality the world over. The 20th Century Fox has a new picture out, a picture about show people. It's called My Mother Once Died. Very nice picture. It's a very nice song in it, too. Who knows how much I love you? You do. No one means more to me than you do.
That is fantastic quality when you think about the time this machine was built.
And how many times this tape has been played.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
Do you know what preceded the tape recorder?
No.
The wire recorder.
Ah, we forgot the wire recorder.
Yeah, we have here a World War II era wire recorder, and they used a very thin, thin piece of wire. And again, we have samples out here that you can feel and touch.
That's like a human hair.
Yeah. So this wire ran past a magnetic head at 2 feet per second. And, well, I've got a little sample right here. You can hear.
And where was this used?
This is primarily a dictation machine.
It was a pretty good quality.
Well, we used for a source for that recording an MP3. So what you just heard was an iTunes download that we recorded to wire.
On this machine?
Yeah, on this
machine. Oh, for heaven's sake.
But normally these were used for dictation and weren't really good enough for I've never seen a pre-recorded wire. Here's the original wire recorder.
The original?
Well, Poulsen, the guy who invented the wire recorder, had an American company here as early as 1911. And the only microphones they used back then were carbon mics.
This has two drums that are about 7 inches in diameter, 6 inches maybe, full of this human hair size steel wire, and it moves rapidly across a recording or playback head, correct?
Yeah.
And that's how they did it.
But they didn't have vacuum tubes back then. They didn't have amplifiers. So they were doing this, they're playing this back over phone lines.
And to listen to it directly, how would you do that? You plug a pair of headphones into
it?
Yes,
yes.
Okay. Now, Steve, one thing our listeners are really interested in is antennas for DX reception. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things I noticed when I walked in here was some loop antennas. And that technology goes back pretty much to the beginning, doesn't it?
That's true. You know, the first radios, if they were sensitive enough, could use a loop antenna. And that was really the big selling point for the Super Heterodyne. You know, Armstrong's original Super Heterodyne had a loop antenna instead of a long wire.
And there are all sorts of different permutations of loops here, and I suppose all these things were subject to experimental development. One worked better than the other, so it sold better. But
well, we have a group that meets here called the Minnesota DX Club, and they're still experimenting with loop antennas even today, and we have a variety of their prototypes on display in different places here at the museum. And if you're interested in radio, I urge you to consider joining the Minnesota DX Club. They're a friendly group, they're knowledgeable, and they love to talk about radios and reception and antennas.
Well, now we're standing in front of the 1929 RCA Theremin. This was built by the RCA we know and love.
Yes.
This is Carl again. All right.
Hello.
Show us how this works, and what is a theremin?
Well, theremin was the first electronic instrument, and the way the theremin works is there's a vertical rod, and the closer you get to that, the higher the pitch goes, and then there's a horizontal rod. The closer you get to that, the lower the volume goes.
So it's the body capacitance thing?
Yes.
So your body gets near this. Okay, mm-hmm. Got it. He's moving closer, and his left hand is adjusting the volume. Now that can be a rather spooky sound. And tell us, what movies were using this for sound effects?
Well, the War of the Worlds did.
See again?
The War of the Worlds used it.
The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah, and I think Spellbound was supposedly the first to use it. And that's kind of what brought the theremin back into the movie business was Alfred Hitchcock's Spellbound.
Mm. This one's 80, almost 90 years old.
You engineers, you can do those math numbers. It's from 1929,
yep.
And it's one of the original 500 that were built.
Wow. Steve, when did the radio go into the car?
I think the 34 Ford had a glove box radio. They claim the Cadillac had a couple models before 34 where it was actually a factory installation. Of course, we like to think that Minnesota did it first because of Bart Setchell. Bart Setchell invented the vibrator. Before that, they could put, I mean, here we've got a 1929 police radio that was used in the Twin Cities.
Well, now, I wanted to sort of drill in on vibrator because we think of it, us radio and engineer guys, think of a vibrator differently than some people might. This vibrator generated that familiar buzz you got when you turned on your car radio way back in the 60s and almost 70s. You still had car radios that had that
115 cycle.
Yeah, kind of a buzzing sound. And what did it do?
Well, when you turned your radio on and you heard that there was a good chance that the radio was going to work. Because back then, radios didn't always work. And these were vacuum tubes that needed 100 volts or 200 volts on the plates. So the vibrator just chopped that DC voltage, and that allowed it to be stepped up through a transformer.
Tesla again.
Yes, Tesla again. Yep. And once you chopped that DC voltage and it stepped up through the transformer, that secondary of the transformer will give you all the different voltages that you need to operate vacuum tubes.
Now we're entering the amateur radio shack, and the call is W0OEP. Are you just going to give us some background on 80 meters? I didn't see what's out there.
Yeah, just give us some noise in the background. We're sitting here in the ham shack today, which is activity here kind of ebbs and flows, but in the past year or so, we've had a number of just dedicated hams who love to come in and make contacts all over the world from the shack. And if you have your license, I invite you to come in and join them and see what you can do on the air. We've got an old tube-type Collins transceiver with a 1,000-watt linear, and they literally make contacts all over the globe with this thing.
So we have touched the surface of what the museum has to offer. Tell us a little bit about the educational mission.
Well, we've got a variety of educational programs. We have a broadcast workshop, which serves thousands of school children every year. They come in for field trips. And we've got an electromagnetism workshop that addresses some of the science standards for fourth graders. We've also got magnets to megahertz, Saturday morning workshop for students about fourth grade, and they put together projects and learn about AC and DC and Ohm's law and electromagnetism and radio, and they actually build a radio and they build an amplifier. And then we've got another class for old guys like me we call Vintage Radio Service, and people are still bringing in radios from the 1930s and 40s and learn how to fix them.
We're also sitting next to a radio studio of the 1960s era.
Well, we do a lot of broadcast workshops with the schools, and they come in and they do radio. They're engineers and they're program announcers and news announcers. There's a teletype feed connected where they get news flashes on an actual teletype machine.
So these are kids in school.
Yeah, this program's designed for fourth through sixth graders, but virtually anybody who comes in for a tour, if they want to do a radio show, we let them, and we help them.
And you're on the air on 1200 today?
1200 a.m., and it's not supposed to go out beyond the building, and it goes about a block.
Yeah, that's great.
One of the things that we try to stress here is when we're doing programs for kids, it's not about us. It's about them, and it's about you.
Wonderful. I can't thank you enough for this time.
I'm honored.
What you, Steve, to me, I think of two five-letter words. I think of PAVIC with a K, and that ties to Steve, or if I use six letters, it's Raymer. But you're synonymous with this operation. You've built it up from a battery collection, a battery radios, to what it is today. What stirs your juices every morning when you come in here?
Well, I love old radios, and I never thought that I would enjoy being around people that much. I used to fix radios, but coming in here has really saved me. Seeing the kids and the enthusiasm and the happiness and the kind of people who come through here and just the nice people in the world, it's done wonders for my state of mind.
Kudos to Steve Raymer and the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting for that great tour through time. The Pavic is always interested in hearing from you. If you're a clicker, you can dial up www.museumofbroadcasting.org or find them on Facebook. They can be reached by phone at 952-926-8198 and by mail at 3517 Raleigh, R-A-L-E-I-G-H, Raleigh Avenue South, St. Louis Park, Minnesota, 55416. I mention these points of contact in the hope that you may see your way to joining the PAVIC's list of supporters and associates. It's a great way to keep radio history alive for coming generations. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We'll be back in this same corner just about a month from now. And until then, good listening, DXers.
Beautiful reissue on Lion Productions of a very obscure album recorded in the mid-1970s by McKay. The album's called Into You, and the track we just heard is Eleanor. That's going to wrap up this edition of the Radio Thrift Shop, cruising up and down the dusty aisles of music from the past century of recorded sound. Any comments, feedback, questions, you can email me at radiothriftshop@gmail.com. That's radiothriftshop@gmail.com. I'll be back soon with another program. Remember, keep exploring the adventurous side of music.